Continuing with Keith Lowe's, and this is the conclusion of chapter 17 of Keith Lowe's Savage Continent, Europe in the Aftermath of World War II, The Jewish Flight. Where did all the Jews go when they were violently ejected by the global state statesmen out of Europe in the statesmen's rush to install one nation per land? Where did all the Jews go was the question we asked last week. The answer, we learned, was that by far the majority wanted to go to Palestine. They were helped in this aim by just about every nation apart from Britain. The Soviets, who were perfectly happy for their Jews to flee Europe, did not place obstacles in their way and open their borders for Jews, but only Jews, to exit. The Poles and the Hungarians, as we have seen, did whatever they could to make life for Jews uncomfortable, and again encourage them to leave by any means possible. The Romanians, Bulgarians, Yugoslavs, Italians, and French all provided ports for Jews to embark on ships bound for the Holy Land, and rarely made any effort to stop them. But it was the Americans who helped the Jews most of all, not by allowing them to come to the United States, but by facilitating their journey towards British-controlled Palestine. They exercised considerable diplomatic pressure on the British to get them to accept 100,000 Jews in Palestine, despite the fact that they themselves officially allowed only 12,849 Jews into America under President Truman's special DP, Displaced Persons Directive. The British were the only ones who tried to stem the flow of Jews from the East. They pointed out that the vast majority were not survivors of Hitler's concentration camps, but Jews who had spent the war in Kazakhstan and other areas of the Soviet Union. Since it was now supposedly safe for them to return to their hometowns, the British did not see why they should be the ones to provide sanctuary for them. The Soviet Union and the countries of Eastern Europe should also be doing their fair share. While they were happy to provide shelter for Hitler's victims in Germany, they drew the line at welcoming a new wave of Jewish refugees that had little to do with the war. Unlike the Americans, they refused these new Jews' entry to the DP camps under their control. The British believed, wrongly as it turns out, that this new wave of Jewish refugees was inspired not by fear of anti-Semitism, but by Zionists who had traveled from Israel to Eastern Europe in order to agitate for recruits to their cause. In fairness to the British, the B'richa movement was indeed made up mostly of Palestinian Zionists, but they were entirely mistaken in their assumption that the new desire to flee to Palestine had originated with them. As historians like Yehuda Bauer have conclusively shown, the impetus to flee came exclusively from the refugees themselves. All the Zionists were doing was providing them with a place to aim for. The British also argued passionately that it was morally wrong, particularly in the aftermath of the Holocaust, to allow the flight of European Jews toward Palestine. According to the Foreign Office, it was surely a council of despair. Indeed, it would go far by implication to admit that the Nazis were right in holding that there was no place for Jews in Europe. The British Foreign Secretary himself, Ernest Bevin, strongly believed that, quote, there had been no point in fighting the Second World War if the Jews could not stay in Europe, where they had a vital role to play in the reconstruction of that continent, unquote. For all their appeals to moral philosophy, the real reasons behind British reluctance were political. They didn't want to create a potentially explosive situation between Arabs and Jews in the Middle East, but without the robust cooperation of any of their partners in Europe, there wasn't really much they could do to prevent the westward flight from continuing. Their efforts to prevent Jews from arriving in Palestine were a little more successful, and ships in the Mediterranean carrying tens of thousands of Jewish immigrants were boarded by the Royal Navy and redirected to special DP camps in Cyprus. But this was merely a case of King Canute trying to hold back the tide. In the end, there was little the British could do to stop the course of events. Called U.S. determination. I'm sorry, continuing. In the summer of 1946, Zionists began a campaign of terror against the British in Palestine, a campaign that was the main cause of the rise of anti-Semitism in post-war Britain. The following year, the British started to scale down their military presence in Jerusalem. At the end of November 1947, after intense lobbying by Zionists, the United Nations voted to award part of Palestine to the Jews for the formation of their own state. And then finally, in 1948, after a close-run civil war between the Jews and Arab Palestinians, the State of Israel was consolidated. The Jews were free to make one small corner of the world their own. And my interjection, isn't this a testament? I mean, reading the truth of it and then listening to the news today, the coverage of the situation today, isn't it a testament to the power of control of the media, control of the educational system, control of the message, control of what thoughts get out there, that I would bet you the vast majority of folk believe that the Israeli state was, I guess I should put it like this. I would imagine that the vast majority of folk in the U.S. are not aware how recently the Israeli state was established. And that if these same events that happened to the Palestinians happened to them, they would never accept it, not for a minute, not for a minute. And as we're about to read, they had nothing to do with the Holocaust. Why should they be made to pay for it? As the Palestinian historian we're about to quote is going to say, continuing,